Hello, this is Mark Steiner, and welcome to Soundbites This Week. We have a great episode today. We're going to talk with Ann Valesis, author of Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From, and Why We Need to Get It Back. We'll have a fascinating conversation about culinary traditions. We'll also speak with Liam Flynn and Steve Marsh, who are running Open Plow, a Baltimore-based coalition of farmers, entrepreneurs, educators, community people, and chefs. We're working together to build a food hub for local residents in the Station North neighborhood of Baltimore.
If you go and source the local stuff, you can't put a premium price on it. I mean, it's sort of, I think that's a misconception that local and organic has got to be really expensive.
Open Plow is a project of Fusion Partnerships, and we'll hear a St. Patrick's Day recipe. But first up is Joel Salatin. So we're about to talk to Joel Salatin, who has become, for many people and many of us, the kind of the face of the new farming movement. He's written so many books, 8 books. His latest is Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. He's a full-time farmer in the Shenandoah Valley down in Virginia, Polyface Farms, the farm of many faces. And he's a third-generation alternative farmer. And Joel, welcome. Good to have you here on The Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Just a quick piece of history. I've seen you in film before and other times you've spoken. Your farm has been the family for a long time. What do you mean it's a three-generation alternative farm?
Well, when Mom and Dad bought the farm in 1961, they bought it with the intention of being a ecological, non-chemical, pasture-based operation. And although they never were able to make a living from the farm, they bought it, worked off the farm in order to pay for it. So when Teresa and I got married, then we, we took that platform and then built the business on top of it, which was, a pasture-based, carbon-centric, compost-driven, ecological farm.
But I guess in your dad's day, it was just tougher to make a living at it. The world has changed. Is that what happened?
Well, no. It's just that the farm could pay a living. It could pay a wage or pay the mortgage, but it couldn't do both.
Right.
So, as is so often the case, he and Mom worked out, put every extra penny into paying the mortgage and got it paid off in a decade. And then that created a platform to where we could, next generation could take it and run with it.
So, you've written a lot of books, and I could spend probably hours and hours talking about each one of the books that you've written, but we're just going to focus a bit on what you've been talking about lately. And it's been interesting because one of the debates we have on the show a lot that you get, and the question you get asked, I'm sure ad nauseum all the time, is the kind of farming you do and a lot of farmers are doing now is a niche farm. It can't really feed people. We need our massive farmers to do it. Everything I've read you've written, you really are kind of an eloquent spokesman as to why that's bunk.
Well, yes. The feed the world thing is certainly one of the most common questions that I get. And so let's take a couple of points here. One is that for the first time in human history, half of the food that's produced for humans, that's human edible, we're not talking about, not edible food, we're talking about edible human food, half of it never gets eaten. A lot of that is due to, people demanding unblemished food, but primarily it's because we have a segregated food system. We don't have a good integrated salvage type operation. I mean, I was recently in California doing a conference with a guy that just come back from Zimbabwe. He'd been at a green bean canning factory in Zimbabwe shipping to the European market, and they were running through 5 tons of green beans a day but only canning 2 and throwing away 3 tons. I says, what was wrong with all those other beans? He said, well, they were either too long, too short, too crooked, And that's the problem. We have such a segregated food system that we don't have good integrated approaches for, all this other stuff. Second point, I think, is runs right along with that, and that is that the idea that a Tyson chicken house or a Smithfield confinement factory house is, or a monocrop of corn or monocrop of soybeans is more productive per square yard than something else is simply not true. When you multi-speciate, so you have a lot of different animals in proximity, that is far more productive per square yard than a single species. Sometimes it doesn't look as awesome, because you're not overwhelmed by the smell and the power of all these things in one place. But the the bottom line of multi-speciation is always more productive. And finally, I would say that the poorest quality backyard garden is actually more productive per square yard than the most productive monospeciated produce operation, you know, the sheer volume of per square yard. The fact is there's a lot of waste in the system. It's segregated, so there's no place for the integrated salvage to go. The diversified operation is far more productive, and a backyard garden is even more productive than anything out there in the industry.
Of course, people will say this, you can't raise the amount of chickens, the amount of meat, the amount of vegetables you need that way, that free-range chickens are not going to put a chicken on everybody's plate.
Again, it's simply not true. Now, I'm not sure you can raise them as cheaply, and that gets into the second most common question,
right?
Is this not really just an elitism movement? So let's address the price issue, because price goes hand in hand. It's when people say you can't feed the world this way, lots of times there's kind of this unspoken elephant in the room, as cheaply as we do today. But you have to understand that the cheap food policy that we currently have has what is called unintended consequences or collateral damage. And that is a pharmaceutical industry in which something like five times the amount of drugs that are used in the human population used in animals. So we have this, drug, problem that's created, MRSA and C. diff and all sorts of pathogenicity in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, those are costs that are created due to monospeciation, factory farming, and the quote-unquote economies that are achieved that don't all often get put on the same balance sheet as the production business. It's fascinating to me that you have a production business that has its balance sheet. For example, the drug company that has its balance sheet, the two are really offsetting expenses, but that's not the way they're accounted for. When you look at soil loss, the U.S. now has more than 700 hydrologic dead zones, the largest one being, of course, in the Gulf of Mexico, which is the size of New Jersey. That is a direct collateral damage. The fact that entire area can't produce seafood, can't produce crustaceans, that is a direct collateral damage. And so, I could go on in this vein, but the point is that when you shortcut ecological principles, that is never a regenerative, sustainable system. Somebody's going to have to pay for that, and society pays for it in other ways, whether it's pollution abatement, whether it's sickness, disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, autism. I mean, there are numerous kinds of things, especially then when you have food that is nutrient deficient. We are now seeing an unprecedented nutrient deficiency as we measure now the nutrient analysis of all foods, and that's that's profound in human history.
And of course, right here, there's a huge dead zone right in the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, it's everywhere you go, it's everywhere, and it's growing.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, 35 years ago, Americans spent 18% of their per capita income on food and 9% on health care. Today, those numbers have inversed, and we're spending 18% on health care and 9% on food. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to assume that those two numbers have some relation. Now, are they a 100% correlation? I don't know. But there's certainly, a correlation between those two numbers, and certainly a correlation in the, externalized consequences of, things like the Chesapeake Bay and that sort of thing. Those are all indicative of ecological shortcuts.
I think for a lot of people in America, though, that is at the heart of the dilemma about trying to figure out how to shift the nature of our food system. Has to do with the fear of cost. I mean, because people are we're used to paying a little bit of money for the food, not as much as our parents did and our grandparents did. And so, right?
Here's the answer. One of the best ways that you can eat, much, much higher quality food without spending any more money is to get unprocessed food. Michael Pollan talks about this in Omnivore's Dilemma and his other books, where if you get unprocessed food and you process it yourself, then you prepare it package it, process it, preserve it in your own kitchen, you know, you can eat a lot cheaper. I mean, you can go to the most prestigious, expensive, elitist, if you want to call it, farmer's market in New York City, you know, artisanal Peruvian blue fingerling potatoes, and they're still only $2 a pound. Potato chips in the supermarket are $4.65, you know, to, you know, $4.99 a pound. So you take your fry baby, you put some lard in there from a pastured hog, and you melt it down, and you use your Cuisinart, and you make your own French fries. Processed food's expensive, and there's no reason why that can't be done. The fact is that people want a system that's changed, a system with integrity, without having to participate in it. And no more than you can have a marriage that has integrity unless you participate in it, you can't have a food system that has integrity unless you participate in it.
Now, you're also saying there's two things that are kind of humorous in a sense, but they're not, because you're very serious about them, which is, A, not to be afraid of cow farts, and B, when you said that you think people should kind of get rid of their canaries and pet dogs and start having pet chickens, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a fundamentally integrated system. You know, chickens. I call them kitchen chickens.
Chickens.
Historically, chickens were the salvage operations for domestic culinary arts. You know, potato peelings, tomato peelings. You made applesauce. You had apple peelings, including spoiled or blemished fruit or vegetables, whatever. The fact is that if every kitchen in America had enough chickens attached to it to eat the scraps out of that kitchen, there would not even be an egg industry in the U.S. That's the truth. So a fundamentally integrated system, you know, is part and parcel of the whole program. And yes, two chickens are certainly no dirtier or, you know, more of a problem to keep than a gerbil cage or an aquarium or a pet canary.
Right.
In fact, when you want to look at it, a dog eats as much food and makes more poop than 11 chickens. So there you go. I mean, we're spending all this money on dog food and cat food, and if we put that on kitchen chickens using our kitchen scraps, not only could we, you know, make something productive out of that, and anybody that thinks a chicken isn't as lovable as a dog just hasn't had a couple of chickens. And next, of course, is that all those scraps would not have to go into the garbage, which then go on a diesel truck to be shipped somewhere to a landfill or a composting operation. So, you know, again, that's a fundamentally integrated system.
When you talk about the amount of acreage we have in this country that we lose for lawns and for housing and horses and everything else that you write about.
Yes.
So talk about that. What does that really mean in terms of what we should, could be using for food and what, you know, and how you think that might work in a better way?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got 36 million acres of lawn in this country and 36 million acres growing the feed and housing recreational horses. So that's between 70 and 72 million acres. That is enough to produce all the food for our entire country without a single farm. So when you start looking at that, you realize just how wasteful we are, with our land use.
So, I mean, I want to kind of figure out really, all the things I've read that you've written, I've read a lot of what you've written, is how you think that system shifts. Do you know what I mean? I mean, in a very concrete way, how you think that that you get to the point where, there are a lot of farmers like you. I know a lot of them on the shore and other places, and they raise chickens for Purdue and they raise chickens for Tyson and everybody else. That's how they make their living for the most part, and they have some side operations on the farm as well. But so, I mean, how do you see those farmers surviving as farmers? A and B, the system shifting. What's your vision of that?
The vision is for two things. First of all, it shifts one person at a time. It doesn't shift, you know, overnight. We haven't gotten where we are overnight. We won't get out of where we are overnight. So it shifts simply, you know, one person at a time. And you know, don't feel like that your decisions or your change is insignificant. The fact is that what we have today is the result of, you know, billions and billions and billions of little decisions that people make, you know, whether they go on the Caribbean cruise or wait a week and wait till the till the tomatoes all come in before frost, can those, make salsa out of them, and then go on a Caribbean cruise. You know, it's,
right.
It really does come down to that, those kind of simple decisions. Now, as far as those farmers, for example, on the Eastern Shore that are producing, you know, big factory farmed poultry, things like that, what would happen is that those farms would begin producing pastured poultry. Rather than being in confined houses, that poultry would be out on pasture, fresh air, sunshine, running around. They wouldn't produce as many chickens, but if they, and the processing would be done by the farmer or by very small abattoirs instead of great big processing plants. So that by decentralizing, when you begin decentralizing the food system, then you start bringing the processing, the distribution, and the marketing, you make it more local-centric. And as you localize that entire production, processing, distribution, and marketing system, there's a lot more money for the farmer to keep. There's a lot more money for the rural area to keep. And suddenly you start balancing and flowing the economy instead of farmers simply being colonial peasants growing raw commodities for value adding and marketing and all that, you know, in the urban sector. The farmers actually become a flow of money from the urban sector to the rural sector. Then you have thriving rural communities instead of dying rural communities. You know, I'm not after some national program to change, and I'm not after, you know, some edict or mandate or whatever, but as people begin changing, the market begins to change and adapt. But you put your finger on why the industry despises what people like me do, because it's very threatening to the the power, position, profit, and prestige of the entrenched industry right now. It doesn't mean that those folks won't have plenty of things to do and can still sell and produce. Maybe they'll produce cows and chickens and tomatoes and cantaloupes instead of just chickens in a factory house. So, you know, you go to a diversified operation. But all of those things are very scary and threatening,
right,
to the industry, which thrives on on single species type production.
I mean, one of the things, because you talk about how slow the process might be, because what you were just commenting on, because you've also, I mean, when I read some of the stuff you've written about the role that synthetic fertilizer industry played around the war, World War One, World War Two,
yes,
in building this industry, and because it wasn't a conspiracy, it just happened to be, it all fell into place with where the economy was going at that time, which,
yes,
was getting bigger. And so it took 70, 80 years for this to happen. It'll be the same process.
Yeah, exactly. The first supermarket came in 1946. You know, believe it or not, there are actually still people alive that remember 1946.
Right.
So
there are. There are.
so the fact that something came in that recently, it can leave as fast as it came in. People have a short memory, though, you know, and things that we think are completely entrenched and necessary just because they are our reality certainly doesn't mean that they have to be, or they have to be that way. And we see the way things change. I mean, the second news section of the Wall Street Journal yesterday, front page, big article on, you know, pork futures and how it's unprecedented. It's never happened in history that in 3 months, you know, pork futures has shot up something like 30%. Never happened before. Why? Because 25% of all baby pigs now in the industry are dying from a viral diarrhea, a brand new, you know, epizootic that just hit last April.
Huh.
Haven't been able to get a hold of it. You know, those are the kinds of cracks in the industry when you make shortcuts, ecological shortcuts. Those are the kind of cracks that people like me see, and you wonder, you know, where's the tipping point where we suddenly don't have a new drug, you know, where we don't have a way to continue shortcutting the system, and we're forced by ecological necessity to come back to a carbon-centric, local-centric, diversified, biomimicked type of food system.
That gets to the point that I think is the kind of positive spin you think about these things in. I don't mean that in a negative sense
yes.
at all. But that where you see that what you're arguing is not about scarcity, but it really is about abundance. That's what you see.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes. And you know, so many times the current industrial food paradigm, you know, views nature as something that's fundamentally broken and needs to be fixed, whereas we view nature as something that's functioning extremely well, and we come along to simply massage it or caress it, not as an enemy to be subdued, but as a lover to be encouraged. And so this is not about scarcity. It is fundamentally about abundance. And the fact is that the earth is a very, very abundant place. And if we come to it with humility rather than hubris, as a nurturer rather than a conquistador, the earth will respond in kind.
Well, Joel Salatin, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I hope that in between your farming, talking, and writing that we'll have a chance to talk to you again.
Well, I hope so, and I appreciate your interest in this and look forward to being out in your neck of the woods.
Thank you. Be safe. I'm here with Liam Flynn and Steve Marsh of Open Plow. Liam is the owner of Liam Flynn's Ale House in Baltimore. Steve Marsh is a chef, brewmaster, and farmer, and they're founders of Open Plow. We're here at Liam's Ale House on North Avenue, Station North Arts, with Liam Flynn and Steve Marsh. It's a great little bar, and now they're serving food.
Finally. We're open almost 3 years without having food. You know, it's hard enough to get folks up to North Avenue. I mean, it's getting easier with the neighborhood changing and all the excitement going on with the arts and music. But when I first opened, I created a list to see how many people wanted food. And there was like a dozen or two dozen people a day that would come in and either turn around and go back to the theater or try and find something. It was really hard to find food up here. After about 6 months of that checklist, I gave up and just tried to find ways to get food. And after a while, we found that I wanted to get my own license. I was on the landlord's license for a while. So to save money, we had to get a kitchen anyway. Looking around, working with folks, I met Steve down at Heavy Seas. We were putting cask ales together. And after a while, decided to work together and get the kitchen open.
And you're the cook,
yes.
Chef.
Yes.
Creator of the food,
yeah. We do. I've been sort of grilling since I was very young. So the idea to bring local food and bring the local beef and everything and actually smoke it here on premises and then serve it to the customers is that. And local beer is kind of where I'm coming from.
So the food is locally sourced? Mm-hmm. For the most part.
Yeah. And we're actually probably going to grow a lot of our own vegetables this year, too. We're growing specific vegetables for the restaurant, both here and lots in the city. We're going to work with a few people in the city. I've got about a half acre property myself, and out in Mount Airy, it's still Point Farm again. They've offered us as much property as you would want, so we'll probably plant at least some tomatoes and some things that we'll be able to use in the restaurant here.
I mean, this is an Irish bar. You got to plant potatoes and rutabagas and turnips, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, around here, the interesting thing with working with local urban farmers, city farmers is like the kohlrabi and other root vegetables. Well, that's more related to cabbage and what have you. But some of the ingredients we can use locally to make traditional recipes, Scottish and Irish recipes, and it's been going very well. I think one of the main things is the freshness and the vitamins and the flavors all there with when you grow locally and you source your meat locally, everything. You don't have the preservatives.
There's no antibiotics used in the beef. They're all fed. The guys go to the local grocery stores and use the remains of cabbage and stuff from local grocery stores. Pigs are all fed very natural.
Our menu does reflect our cultural traditions, and we would like to expand. You know, it's going to take time to expand more because we have to go through our first year of seasons. But a lot of this is help we're getting is with the Open Plow Project, and that's kind of what's been educating ourselves and our neighborhood. We're almost creating our own client base where there was none before for this type of food. Having worked with the neighbors and saw the need for healthy food and the need for education on what is healthy food, and that you had giving access and education really helps out, and people start to taste the difference.
You're talking about two things. I mean, one, when you talk about neighbors, you're talking about the neighbors who, this is their neighborhood, who've lived here in the public housing projects in the community around.
Chavin, Story Branch.
Right. The other thing is there's a lot of groups. There's Safe and Sound, Charles Co-op Garden up here. There's a lot of different gardens that are all sort of just floundering around and don't really have access or a way to get, they can produce the food, but they don't have anywhere for it to go.
That was Steve Marsh. You also heard Liam Flynn. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of my interview with Liam and Steve, and then we'll meet Ann Valesis, author of Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm speaking with Liam Flynn and Steve Marsh. We're running Open Plow, a Baltimore-based coalition of farmers, entrepreneurs, educators, community people, and chefs who are working on building a food hub for local residents in the Station North neighborhood of Baltimore. Open Plow is a project of Fusion Partnerships. Liam is owner of Liam Flynn's Ale House in Baltimore, where we caught up with both Liam and Steve. Steve Marsh is a chef, brewmaster, and farmer.
One of the things that you said when you talked about the community is that sometimes when we talk about urban farming, mm-hmm. what gets left out is the people who've lived in the city the longest, whose city mm-hmm. this is, who right. live in the neighborhood. It's always kind of for the restaurants, for right. somebody else's neighborhood, never for the people who live in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, we came into the area, we didn't want to necessarily just be seen as this foreign outsider. So we made a close connection, went around talking to folks like Jay Van Story Branch. They have folks that want to garden, who want to eat healthier, have a few health issues of their being originally a senior center. That we worked with them and saw what they needed, tried to match that and just help bring about making the folks healthier that are already here. They, you know, they have mobility issues because the sidewalks aren't getting fixed. And although they want to go out and garden, they want to eat healthy, they just don't have the ability to do it. And we're hoping to help them with that by offering it ourselves and through Open Plow, helping them produce and process vegetables, identify to help themselves.
So describe Open Plow.
Open Plow is a collaboration, local collaboration of chefs, farmers, entrepreneurs. Well, I guess we started kind of with the North Avenue Market and looking at North Avenue, but we're seeing how this can affect the whole city and not be sort of a centralized idea to where people teach people how to grow, how to process, how to do everything, you know, make sure that they're growing healthy, test, give them access to soil testing, and access to a kitchen for potentially for education, you know, classes, work with the local chefs who have offered to come in and teach people how to cook properly, even the basics to whatever their special is. So we're pulling from a local pool to help out locally, but Open Plow is trying to create a model that can be emulated around the city, anywhere from faith-based kitchens, in churches, what have you, could be sort of a food hub themselves. Food hubs are a great idea, but the way that they're approached, like you say, are this sort of glorious, held on high, you know, only those who know can eat well.
Right.
Which is completely wrong because...
They've priced themselves out of the customer that we're trying to teach us about healthy food. If you go and source the local stuff, you can't put a premium price on it. I think that's a misconception that local and organic has got to be really expensive. Things can be grown locally that do great here and can benefit not only the population here, but also all the restaurants. So it's really hard to like run a business and then also have a nonprofit. We're really working hard to try to help out the neighborhood, but of course, like we have to run a business also. So that's been one of our biggest biggest goals is to get people in here, and yeah, I think the education is more important than anything. Educate, show people how to cook.
It takes quite a bit more work. It's not as convenient as the food that, you know, is at the bodega. But, you know, the outcome is great, and there's a lot of people looking for stuff to do. And these basic preparation skills could lead to employment in the industry, or in production, food and beverage industry, anywhere from production to service.
Right. A lot of people would argue that urban farming production is going to become key in this century to feeding people, given what's happening everywhere else. Yeah. This is that the urban centers are much more integral and important to this than people realize, I think.
Yeah, Baltimore City has a lot of vacant properties, and there's no reason we can't utilize them. We just need the assistance of the city, state, federal agencies to make things like that happen. I think they're willing.
So I'm curious how this began, even.
Well, no, I came to Baltimore as a merchant marine and then started working with Black Planet Books, which ultimately became Red Emma's. And then I had the opportunity to open a little place on Charles Street called Liam's Pint Size Pub. And there I had met Mike Schechter, who I think right at about that time, around 2007 or something, said that he had gone in with Carolyn Frankel in this building. So, and that they were looking for folks to come up, local talent, if you will, to come up and help revitalize the area. And it took a long time. It's everything up here seems to take a long time to get completed. But when we went into, like we were talking before, when we went in to get our new license and get the kitchen certified and everything, it just took so long. The bureaucracy was ridiculous. We had to cut a few things, like we have to reapply for outdoor seating, which I think will be great for this area. But other than that, once we cut off everything and streamlined it, it still took 5 hours in four different buildings, which were right across the street from each other. So.
I mean, I will say that when I was here the other night, mm-hmm. It's good food.
Yeah, it's
that's really good food.
A lot of it's been sort of family recipes that I've tweaked over the years, and watching Mom and, you know, the Cooking Channel way too many hours. Always loved the kitchen. I was always getting in the way in the kitchen. You know, my fingers were always in the pot. You could add a little pepper, Mom, or, you know, that kind of deal. But most of these recipes have been things that I've been working on for probably 20, 25 years. The jerky I started brewing about 30 years ago. So it was all sort of grew all kinds of things in my garden for putting into beer. And that's actually where I met Liam, was at Heavy Seas. I started the cask program there, and I had a lot of chefs come in, and we'd build a cask together, and they'd base a dinner
cask
around
for the beer.
Yeah, it's an English cask, you know, right. The old traditional right. style
right.
cask.
As opposed to draft keg, there's a difference.
It's unfiltered beer. So basically you're taking unfiltered beer right as it's done. You're maybe adding a little sugar to get that yeast excited, just enough to give it a little carbonation, and then we put a cheesecloth bag with... In Liam's case, it was ginger or
heather
and a couple other things. Yeah. In that, and then working with the chefs for years and putting beer in food. Or if you'll notice, most of the recipes have beer in them.
Yeah.
So taking some of the beer, putting a couple cups in it, and finding, you know, hey, this hop works really, hops works really well with spicy food, whereas, you know, big malty beer works well with our pie, say the steak pie.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun going... back and forth out to Mount Airy and meeting the farmers like Tom at Still Point and folks out there. It's just been great because we have this connection that it seems so natural, and you wonder why other folks don't do it. And if we, I think if we ever had to like cheapen our recipes and go like the Cisco route, we would just close the kitchen. It's just
basically we need customers. We need people to come in and eat. That's what I want to do. I want people to taste the food. I want them to taste the good beer that we're getting. I mean, we're really trying to, like I say, become locally oriented.
Baltimore is starting to, it seems like there's a lot of good folks out there who are very interested in making Baltimore a better place, especially with food, like where they're going for the cottage food laws. That was one of the things with the Open Plow is we noticed that there are all these great groups, but they're not organized together, and Open Plow is trying to help organize those groups together to be more effective. Like we started on North Avenue, you know, one side you've got Boone Street Farm, and then you've got Hidden Harvest, you've got Baltimore Free Farm, and the Whitlock Community Garden, all these places springing up. But they could be more effective by organizing together, you know, all the resources. We're working with the Man Alive Treatment Center up the street to put in a meditation labyrinth up the street in a vacant lot.
The goal with what Open Plow is doing is actually getting the people that are all hanging around here just mingling and get them up to maybe up into the garden and give them things to do with their hands.
This is good. I mean, I had no idea that it was this, that the organizing was as intense and as serious.
Very intense organizing, getting everybody to work together.
Well, it takes time.
Yeah. A lot of people, especially last year, people just looked at us like we had three heads. You know, there's no way you can do all this. You know, it is pretty broad, and there's only like 15 members on Open Plow. So we have to work with other organizations to get everything to happen. It's coming together. It seems to be a natural thing.
You want to give us a recipe, Steve?
Lamb stew. Last year we did the steamed potato cold cannon. This year, just a basic lamb stew is good.
Yeah, I'd suggest like a lamb shank, probably brown the lamb shank with maybe some onions and garlic, sort of braise it, and then put it, then braise some carrots and onions and. What else did we say?
Some rutabagas. Typically, traditional recipes, you'll see turnips, but the closest thing to a Swede or a like a British Isles turnip is actually a rutabaga.
Much larger and very waxy, usually. They're purple and purple on the top.
Yeah, a lot more flavor, definitely. And thyme is always a big herb to be used in British Isles cooking, Irish, Scottish.
So it'd be rosemary is generally a lamb spice. So I'd say rosemary, thyme, garlic, brown the carrots and all the vegetables with that.
Deglaze the pot or pan that you did the meat in its own fat. Usually is a good way of doing it. And then you have the meat, the vegetables, stir those in a little, saute them a little, put in the potatoes. You know, put the deglaze on it.
Of course, some wine or beer, whichever your choice is. Yeah. So I'd say a red wine or a darker beer, probably a stout.
Yeah.
That and some water.
So, and deglazing is when you put water in and you've got all the chunky, fatty bits, and you just whisk those off the bottom and add in. It'll mix itself up as a stock.
It makes for cleaning the pot a little easier later, too.
Oh, yeah. Don't let it sit there.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and you could throw in a little, once you bowl it up, plate it up, however you want to do it, then you throw in a little parsley and some bread. Garnet. Now, a good stout I could recommend right now if you want to go local is Still Point Farms, their Milk House Brewery. They have a dry Irish stout.
Well, we look forward to tasting all this coming back. Well, thank you both, Liam Flynn and Steve Marsh. Thanks for letting us come in.
All right. It's luncher.
Have a good day.
Luncher. So joining us on Soundbites now is Ann Valaisis, who was in Chestertown last week to speak at the series that we'll be covering a great deal from Washington College. Her book is Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. She wrote other books before, Discovering the Unknown Landscape, A History of American Wetlands. And Ann Valaisis, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
Oh, you're a serious historian, that's clear.
Yeah, I still like big books. Fat books with lots of stories.
Nothing wrong with fat books with stories. They keep us going. You start with this woman, Martha, 1790, Martha Ballard, kind of painting a picture of when we had knowledge. Talk a bit about her, that period.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I was trying to figure out how do I get a sense of what it was like to cook a meal and what it was that people used to know about their food. I mean, that was kind of the thing I was keeping my bead on. What did people know about food? How did that change through time? And it was really when I found the diary of Martha Ballard that I was that I got a window into that, because I could find in the pages of her diary the stories of all the foods that she was either growing or cooking. You know, so she would have a meal, and she would mark in her diary the kinds of foods she was cooking. And so, you know, she'd say, have peas and cucumber salad or something like that. And I would have been able to read earlier in the year, that the day that she planted the peas and when she watered things, you know, from the creek or how she got the animals that became the mutton or the chicken. Or even one of the things I found in her diary was that she liked the wheat, the bread that she made from the wheat that her husband and sons grew compared to wheat that they got from some other farmer down the road. So there was just this amazing intimacy between her knowledge of place, where the food came from, and as I said, like these stories of the foods as they grew that were part of her life every day. And it was just such a different way of having food in our lives, you know. So it was really fascinating to discover that, think about it.
I want to go through this historical sojourn because I think it's important because what you're trying to do here is paint a framework of what we once had and why we had it in a much less centralized, industrialized world, and how that kind of growth of urban capitalism and bringing people into cities completely changed the nature of our relationship with food. I mean, that's the underlying thesis, right?
Yes, that's exactly the underlying thing. And I didn't want to just write about, you know, everything that went wrong with our food system or
right,
what the problems
right.
are, but more like, yeah, how did that affect the way we even just think about food, because that seemed to be a fundamental change in our human experience. And I just had the sense that if we could investigate that, think about that, but that was also really important to unearth and understand as we think about the other things.
How did we get there? I mean, you walk us through this and Amelia Simmons and her cookbook, American Cookery, which was really the first American cookbook, and that was kind of a weird beginning of a bridge.
Yeah, well, really, you nailed it on the head when you said, I mean, really what happened is we had a period in the late 19th century of increasing urbanization and industrialization. And so to feed growing cities, the food system just changed tremendously. You know, initially in our country, as cities grew, there was a ring of farms around each city. And so there was a period in which, you know, food still was coming fairly locally and was, you know, seasonally grown, what was available. But as cities grew larger and larger and as transportation costs came down, food was able to come farther and farther. And so some of the things that I talk about in my book, for example, are the meat system. You know, it used to be that meat came from right outside the city, but when cities like New York got, Philadelphia got so huge, the meat started coming from the Great Plains. And then, of course, it became, it was transported live, the animals were transported live by railroad. But eventually, that became too cumbersome, and the animals got injured and damaged on route. So that then became an industrial system where the animals were slaughtered in Chicago and only dressed meat was sent, meat separate from the animal, to stores in the cities. And one of the things I traced is not only these technological changes, but the fact that at each step of the way, people had to start thinking about things differently. In the early cookbooks I write about, people were advised to know about the animals' lives. To know about the animals that became meat, you know, things like how old an animal might be, the sex of an animal, what an animal ate, all those kind of things were important for a homemaker, somebody who was cooking, to know. But through this transition, we ended up getting to the point where really all you needed to do was go to the store and buy some cut of meat. That's all you needed to know. And initially, people were very skeptical about that. They didn't like the idea that meat was coming from 1,000 miles away. And so it really required a whole cultural change, a difference in understanding what meat was to get us into this mode now where we just go into the store and buy a package that's plastic wrapped and don't even think anything about where it came from.
The strange thing here is that is when you write about the transitions we've gone through from the time of Martha Ballard, where she knew everything and how a particular vegetable would grow in a certain time of year and the color and texture and feel of the leg of the animal is in the cookbook, and how you would know the age and all that knowledge, people, intimate knowledge that many people had, even if they weren't farming, of what their food and meat really came from, vegetables and meat. You bring us to this point where the growth of people kind of being able to can food and move animals across the country and leading to kind of the problems with health and disease that were propped up there that built this government bureaucracy that actually helped build the industrial agriculture we have today.
Right.
I mean, not out of some kind of conspiratorial zeal, but just the nature of things.
Yeah, it was just, you know, as we had to solve problems, as that food system was haphazardly developing, you know, there were a lot of problems, and especially people didn't understand germs. They didn't understand how to do canning when that technology first came out. So there were lots of cases where, you know, things like botulism, there were cans that swelled. People would eat food that was actually killed them, or there were heavy metals in canned foods because they were soldered with lead. You know, there are all sorts of things like that happening in this emerging haphazard system, you know, the need for some sorts of regulation came into being. The irony of that is some of those many of those regulations were very important to solve problems that were happening at that point. But the irony of that now is that some of those regulations, as you say, have kind of ossified an industrialized system that means that it's almost impossible for smaller food producers and farms to exist because the benefit and the whole system is really geared towards the biggest producers.
Given that that's our reality, one of the things you kind of talk about this is you have this kind of metaphor that food is fuel that feeds the engine of our bodies. You see that in a larger way, how that's connected.
Well, I mean, I think that that metaphor is in part, you know, part of the industrial food system is that metaphor. It's the idea is food is fuel, and so it's entirely possible to just focus on the nutritional value and getting it as cheap as we possibly can. Of course, the problem with that system or that metaphor and that idea is that food actually is so much more meaningful to us on many levels, on many cultural levels. It's not only fuel and it's not only calories, even though those are ways we've been taught at various times to think about it. And I think that's part of what we are realizing more and more now. And that's part of what has fueled, I think, what is an exciting revival or resurgence in tremendous interest in local foods and possibilities of doing things differently, creating alternative food systems, let's say, from that dominant one that supplies the meat at the supermarket.
Well, you write about kind of where this transition took place at, when the meat finally got to Chicago to be slaughtered and then taken in smaller pieces and sent out to the rest of the country, to the east, that there was resistance to that on some people to take food from far away, but it was then cheaper. Do you see that as kind of the flip side of that happening now? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, because this built the industry, but what do you see the dynamic being at this moment?
Well, I think what has happened, I mean, of course, what I think has happened is we went down this path of trying to make food cheap to serve the needs of the industrial economy, and that's what we did, and that's what our food system is really designed to do, is to serve a lot of people with as many calories as cheaply as possible. That's kind of what we were aiming for. And yet, as a result of that, relatively recently, we've come to realize there are tremendous public health costs to that because we're not necessarily eating the things that are good for our body. And there are also tremendous cultural losses from that because food has been divorced from all these meanings that it may have had in the past for us when we knew the stories and where it came from, or we knew how we had a deeper knowledge of how to prepare it as opposed to just putting something into the microwave oven. So I think it's causing many people at least to open up the question of, well, are there other things that are possible? Are there different ways of procuring food? And that's the juncture we're at. And we still have the dominant food system that most people are eating from, but there's more and more people that are saying, gosh, are there other ways to get my food? Can I shop at farmers markets? Can I be engaged in, can I sign up with a farm through community-supported agriculture to get food every week? And those kinds of things they're still at the edge. They still might be considered a fringe, but they are just so much more common everywhere now than they were just 5 years ago. It's been a remarkable growth because people are so interested.
Even though there is this kind of move to for kind of locavorism and move towards people, the proliferation of farmers markets in this country. I mean, how do you see where we are now in a historical sense of what might be really shifting, given A, that the size of America, that most people shop in supermarkets, that they want to get their food in a relatively easy way, and this other sense of kind of reaching back to look forward with this whole locally grown, organic, however you want to describe it, food movement. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're trying to say. It's like, can that other system really feed us? I mean, it's in some ways, I think, what you're asking.
And in a sense, but it's part of it, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think it can. It certainly can't right now. I think we have to look forward to not one or the other, but continuing to have both. I mean, I think we have to try to do is take the best from both worlds in a certain sense. You know, I mean, the system that we have, as I described, was invented to solve problems and needs in our society. And it did in many respects, but it fell short in many respects too. And so as we move forward, I think what's exciting is there is this interest in local food stuff that is cropping up all across America. And yet it's going to coexist with the other system, but hopefully it will function to press that other system in better directions. I think one of the really interesting examples that's come up with this is that, of course, the federal government subsidizes the production of commodity foods, you know, that's corn, soybeans, those sorts of things, to a tremendous degree, but not the growth of vegetables, which are usually grown by smaller farmers. And that's become clear that that's just crazy in terms of public health, because vegetables are so important for us to be eating. And so, you know, those types, becoming aware of those things means that at least now on a policy level, we're struggling to try to make changes to get those things lined up in a better direction for public health at a larger scale, as well as the kinds of things I'm talking about, which is people wanting to eat fresher, better food and enjoying it in many different levels, not just as fuel. Of course, a couple years ago, there was a lot of hype about the Farm Bill and being able to push it and change it in ways that would be more helpful to support organic agriculture. And then, of course, just more recently in the last Congress, it's just been almost impossible to change it at all. I think it's just been extended in ways,
right,
you know, that don't, there's no reform. I think we're just struggling to figure out what that path is ahead, is where we're at.
Because we're even in a place now where, is he right about organic food and the struggle to define what that means and how that happened in the United States during our history of food and growing food in this country. I mean, most of our organic food now, the majority of it that people buy in supermarkets, is grown in a semi-industrial model in large farms in California and other places.
Yeah.
That the rest of us eat. I mean, right. If I want to go to the store and buy carrots and they're organic, well, those organic carrots I buy are going to be from California most likely.
Yeah, they're going to be from California and a really big farm.
Right.
But they're going to be grown without pesticides. And so, I mean, and they're going to be grown in a farm that, you know, it's moved the trigger or whatever, the arrow a little bit in one direction, I would say in a better direction for the environment, for people that raise food, for our health, in a little bit. But you're right. It's not perfect.
But you see it progressing.
I see it progressing, and I think especially with, you know, as we see sort of political intransigence, people want to do something and take the bull by the horns. And so that's why I think we're also seeing this just resurgence of local agriculture. People, I mean, I can't tell you, as I've gone from different places talking about my book, realizing that people are so interested and excited about figuring out how to get local foods into their communities. They're figuring out, how do we start a farmer's market? And if there's no farm around, they're asking, well, gosh, how do we get farmers to come to our area? How do we, you know, someplace I was in New England, and one town was telling me they had to start a land trust to preserve farmland so that they could get farmers. I mean, it's pretty much going back to square one to try to figure out how to get farmers in your community. But isn't that an amazing motivation that people are having to try to figure out how to do that right now?
Absolutely. And Anne Velisis, this has been a wonderful conversation. The book is Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. And we will be connecting to her and the other stuff of the series that is taking place at Washington College in Chestertown. And thanks you so much for joining us here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, and made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.